Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross, my co-host, is out this week. The state of Florida and several counties are in states of emergency on this Friday. They were declared that this week as more Floridians test positive for COVID-19, the coronavirus. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday.
So it's important that we, remain vigilant here in the state of Florida. I think taking proactive measures will help us flatten the curve of this as people get exposed.
There has been some confusion and some frustration. Confusion around guidelines and direction for some, and frustration over slow testing and the release of information. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease doctor, testifying at a congressional hearing in Washington, D.C. on Thursday about the lack of testing.
The system is not really geared to what we need right now, what you are asking for. That is a failing. It is a failing. I mean, let's admit it.
We are talking about the COVID-19 virus this hour here in Florida. Coming up, we'll have a Mayo Clinic doctor with us to help answer some of your questions. What questions do you have about the virus? Are you getting the kind of information that you need to make informed decisions for yourself, for your family, for your workplace, for your community? Have the kids' weekend soccer games or baseball games been canceled? Will you go to church or temple because of the virus? How is it affecting your daily life here in Florida? 305-995-1800 is our statewide phone number. 305-995-1800. You can also find us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Let's begin with Mary Mayhew. She is the secretary of the Florida Agency for Healthcare. Secretary Mayhew, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
So tell us from ACA, right? It's the Agency for Healthcare Administration, the state of COVID-19 in Florida.
Tom, my agency is responsible for overseeing the care that is provided to some of our most vulnerable residents in Florida, those individuals who are living in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, adult family care homes. And as you are aware, Governor DeSantis has taken many steps to focus on our efforts to protect our most vulnerable. We have been working closely with our nursing homes, our assisted living facilities, our hospitals, to make sure that we are putting all precautions in place to protect our elderly and those individuals with underlying medical conditions from exposure. And that has been really focused on the screening of visitors, staff, and vendors at our residential facilities, the nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and other residential programs. And Tom, if I could just say real quickly here, I want to speak to family members. I understand how scary this is. And I understand that family members want to be able to be in touch with their loved ones. We are working with providers around the state to provide alternative means when this is necessary for families to communicate. But all of this is being done because of the love and the care being provided to our seniors to protect them. And we understand that they are at greatest risk if COVID-19 and that virus were to get into a long-term care facility. We simply do not want to see the tragedy that unfolded in Washington State, we do not want to see that occur here in Florida.
Secretary Mayhew, should all Florida nursing homes be required to do temperature scans of visitors, vendors, and employees?
Tom, I've had a chance to visit a number of facilities. I certainly have had my temperature taken at those facilities. I've spoken with a number of facilities that have absolutely implemented the temperature taking. We, as you know, as things evolve, we are continuing to focus on directives at the state level to make sure that we are doing everything possible to protect our seniors, and certainly monitoring visitors for a temperature and monitoring our staff in these facilities is critically important.
Should that be a requirement, though? Should your agency perhaps require those homes, for instance, that are participating, have patients participating in the Medicaid program administered through your agency, be required to do temporal checks for
yep.
visitors and vendors?
So we are absolutely looking at additional steps that we will be recommending to the governor. Again, I want to just stress there are many facilities that are doing that voluntarily right now.
Yeah, yep.
But we are definitely looking at a statewide approach.
What are some of those other recommendations, even if draft form, that you could share with us and share with Floridians who are obviously concerned about this vulnerable population?
And again, we are just examining every possible angle, but Tom, trying to balance it against the concerns that families may certainly have about access to their loved ones. But what we are evaluating, as other states have also considered, are more comprehensive restrictions on visitation. Again, as we start to deal with larger volumes of individuals being tested, we want to be prepared to make sure that we've considered every possible angle to protect.
Secretary Mayhew, let me ask you about testing. Should nursing homes have access to those tests when the supplies come to Florida? Will they have access to those tests when there are testing supplies in the state?
So, Tom, it's a great question, and I want to differentiate between collecting specimens that get sent to the lab
mm-hmm.
and the issue of expanding the number of labs that are able to test. And there are certainly issues with both. But to collect the specimen, the entity, the individual physician or the hospital healthcare staff collecting the specimen need to be wearing PPE, personal protective equipment. And what we really want to focus on is if someone has symptoms in a long-term care facility and there's a determination that testing is needed, we're really encouraging nursing facilities to focus on transfer agreements with hospitals. Part of the challenge, Tom, is for a successful containment in a long-term care facility, you need to have staff that are trained and have individually fitted N95 masks and a negative pressure room.
Understood. So is it your sense, though, the message here is that that facilities simply don't have the equipment or the particular right protocol to collect those specimens?
So that is not typically equipment that nursing homes would have. This is a higher standard of infection prevention and control related to this virus.
So just so I'm clear here, Secretary, sorry to interrupt, but for the layman here, we're talking about the collection of specimens that nursing homes typically don't have the kind of equipment necessary to do that properly. Is that right?
That's right, Tom, and that would be true of a primary care physician's office potentially. Which is why today the specimens are being collected at county departments of health and at hospitals.
And
let me just, Tom, if I could just say, for those who meet the CDC criteria for testing.
Right, and that's travel to the target countries that the CDC has identified, including China, South Korea, Iran, and Italy. For people who have been in contact with people who have traveled there within 14 days, as well as those that are exhibiting symptoms, including a high fever. Now, the CDC guidelines have gone one step further, which have provided doctors essentially empowered doctors with the ability to ask for a test, where that additional expansion into the doctor has not happened here in Florida, should it?
First of all, I want to be clear about that the testing criteria really is about those who are at high risk and are symptomatic based upon the criteria you just outlined.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Surgeon General Rifke is working with physicians and other organizations around the opportunity to expand the collection of specimens for those who it is warranted to conduct the test.
Secretary Mayhew, is the Florida health delivery system ready?
So, Tom, it's certainly when you have this level of a challenge that is affecting the entire country, it is putting our emergency preparedness to the test. I will say that for Florida, because of all that we have gone through with other emergencies, both related to hurricanes and the formalized information and communication structure that exists for Florida, but also because of Florida's previous experience with other healthcare-related public health challenges. We have a lot to be thankful for in Florida, but there is no doubt, Tom, that this is putting every state public health system to the test. But what we can say is that Florida today does not have any community spread, that the cases that we see today have a travel-related connection.
There is one case identified just last night by the Department of Health in Broward County that is not travel-related and still under investigation. And as you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci for the National Institutes of Health included Florida in a list of states that he described as experiencing community spread of COVID-19.
I am aware, and I know the Surgeon General has spoken with him personally, because that has not been reported by Florida, but you are correct. There is at least one case that remains under investigation, but it is why we need to be as vigilant as the governor has been to restrict exposure, public exposure in our facilities. And I know your leadership in Miami, elected leadership and healthcare providers are taking additional steps to contain by reducing public events.
And the elected leadership in the city of Miami, the mayor, has tested positive for the virus.
And again, as we know, we are seeing significant effort to provide expanded testing to support local health care providers.
What's the timeline for that, Secretary Mayhew? What's the timeline? The governor's talked about tens of thousands of testing kits. What can Floridians expect?
There are tests that are being deployed as we speak from the Department of Emergency Management and the Department of Health. There are hospitals right now that are focused on bringing up online their capacity to test. I know that is true with several hospitals right now that are conducting tests. I was on a phone call today with several other large hospitals and health systems that are aggressively moving forward to be able to provide that capacity. That will make a huge difference here in Florida.
Secretary Mayhew, thank you for your time. We do appreciate it. Mary Mayhew is the Secretary of the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration. And I know that we will be talking in the weeks ahead as well, Secretary.
Thank you, Tom.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. We want to next bring in Dr. Joseph Servin. He is with the Mayo Clinic at the Jacksonville campus, and he's with us from our sister station, our partner production station in Jacksonville, WJCT. Doctor, welcome to the program. You were just hearing the secretary there of the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration, and as we were talking to her, the President of the United States, President Trump, will declare or has declared a national emergency to combat the coronavirus. What did you hear from the secretary, and what's your takeaway from this presidential announcement here this afternoon?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. What I take away from it is, at the end, we're in a critical juncture at this moment. We are prepared, at least as medical professionals, to handle what comes our way. But just being prepared isn't equivalent to saying it's going to be easy or it's going to be straightforward. Ultimately, what it means is that declaring an emergency, doing everything we can, is how we now start to kind of get involved to the degree that it does not get to that we switch it over to a level that this can be managed and that this all becomes just a collective unpleasant memory as opposed to an entire new normal for all of us.
Julio Choa is also with us, editor of Health News Florida at WUSF, our partner station in Tampa. Julio, you listened to the secretary there. What did you learn as someone's been focused here on the daily ups and downs of mostly ups in terms of increases of cases of COVID-19?
Yeah, well, something that stood out for me was the fact that they're saying there's no community spread. And to be sure that you don't have community spread, you have to test a lot of people. You know, it could be spreading in your community without you knowing if you're not testing them. And the state is following strict testing guidelines for who they test. So they're not testing anyone who's sick or needs to be tested. So it's really hard to say for sure that there's no community spread.
Dr. Servin, how about that idea of community spread? That's been a kind of a key juncture when it comes to public health officials and the ability to try to control the virus and certainly communicate to the public.
I keep hoping that is exactly the case, that we are seeing that what we're hearing in the reports now in Florida, that it is minimal to non-existent. But the truth is, you don't know that until you have a lot of testing done, and testing a lot of people who are not having symptoms and things of that sort. That's how you get the true value. So I keep, in a sense of faith, saying, oh, I hope that's the case. But it gets very complicated once community spread comes in, because then now we're in a kind of a situation where things can bloom very quickly with the number of cases.
Let's squeeze in a quick phone call before we have to go to break. In Fairmont, D on line 5. D, we've got less than 2 minutes. Go ahead, though. D, you with us?
Yeah.
Go ahead, D. We've got less than 90 seconds.
Yeah, I'm calling because I was asked to quarantine because I traveled to a North American country within the last 14 days by my job. I work in a nursing home, and I got no directions from my job. I have called the public health, the Florida Public Health Service. They have no answers for me. I have to complete a 14-day absence paperwork at my doctor. I have to pay $150. I have no income. I have no direction. I am so confused and broke and everything. We need some directions with this. I am not sick. I can't get any benefits. I have no sick time for my work.
D, lots to unpack there. But on the medical side, doctor, any suggestions for her who's ordered to quarantine, works in a nursing home, and traveled to one of the countries?
Number one is it's self-monitoring. Make sure that at the end you try not to infect other people. So that's the obvious piece. Separation, cleanliness, common sense, wearing masks if you do have to come into contact with others. And obviously you can't go to work given where she happens to work is a place that would be of concern. But at the end, don't panic. And ultimately, use common sense in that regard as we get better clarity.
Doctor, stand by with us. Dr. Joseph Servin with the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Julio, you stick around as well. Julio Choa with WUSF Health News Florida. Your phone calls, 305-995-1800. Disney closing, Universal closing, that's still to come as you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host in Jacksonville, Melissa Ross, is off this week. We're talking COVID-19 in Florida, 305-995-1800. Julio Choa is editor at the Health News Florida organization based at WUSF in Tampa. Dr. Joseph Servin is with the Mayo Clinic at the Jacksonville campus. So let's take some more phone calls here in Tallahassee. Mia is on line 3. Go ahead, Mia. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Inevitably, there are going to be millions of us who will be nursing at home with the less critical cases of this. What I'm not hearing is any kind of direction about particularities of nursing or anything that we should be doing or stockpiling to be able to do that nursing. I'd be very grateful to hear Dr. Stevens speak to that.
Go ahead, Mimi, I appreciate that. Go ahead, Doctor.
Sure. So at the end of the day, what we believe is for the vast majority of cases, the symptoms will be mild. So the treatment is what you would typically do for any type of upper respiratory infection. It's the type of fluids, the type of making sure breathing is good, that there's comfort measures, that temperature is managed. The big key in terms of nursing is how to not get the person taking care of that individual sick as well. And so that is where the individual who's sick having to wear masks, a heavy involvement of cleanliness, wiping down surfaces. Remember that this virus is transmitted through respiratory droplets from coughing, sneezing, saliva, or spit. And so trying to be as clean as possible so that the person taking care of them doesn't get sick as well becomes the key element other than taking care of the symptoms.
Julio, I'm curious, you know, we've only had two phone calls here anecdotally here, but both of them asking for more information. They don't feel that they're being armed with the kind of information that they need to make good choices and to continue to move on. What are you hearing in that kind of confusion and frustration?
Right. Yeah. And I will say that the Department of Health and the CDC both have pretty robust sites, and the CDC will lay out, if you have someone at home that you're trying to care for, here's how to do it. And here's how to keep yourself from getting sick or others from getting sick. So she should definitely check out that website for help. But yeah, people are nervous about this. You know, they're not sure what to do if their family member gets sick and they don't want to get their children sick or, you know, older adults that are living with them sick. So, there is a lot of angst and nervousness. And I mean, you're seeing it on the shelves at grocery stores. They're selling out of hand sanitizer and other stuff. So, people are looking for information. We see it on our website hopefully they're getting the right stuff. And I'm, like I said, the Department of Health COVID-19 site is a good place to go, and they will direct you to the CDC as well.
It has been quite a week, as anxiety has continued to get heightened almost every day. And you've seen, obviously, Thursday there were some big decisions made in local communities by local groups and big corporations about canceling and postponing large events and even closing down. Walt Disney World and Universal Orlando announced decisions on Thursday night to close for a period of time. Danielle Pryor from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE, is now with us.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Danielle. What do we know about the scheduled closings? It's this weekend, I think, right?
It is. It's actually starting on Saturday for the parks. Saturday for the cruise lines and Sunday for the parks. And it'll be for the next 2 weeks all the way through the end of March.
And so what are the kind of metrics, the measuring tools the companies are using to decide what comes next?
I think really it's they're just looking at the CDC and the World Health Organization. They're looking at local coronavirus numbers and outbreaks if we have them.
And what about the impact on employees? What do we know?
I think the impact is going to be huge long term, not just for the employees, but for our local economy. We know that Disney said that they're going to go ahead and pay employees throughout the time that the parks are going to be closed, which is great. But I was talking to Eric Clinton of the local 362 today, and he said he's worried about healthcare. What's going to happen with shortened hours, maybe even once the parks do open, and if there's still concerns about cleanliness. And then, of course, worried about the workers who've been cleaning the parks. What are sanitation procedures that are in place to protect them while they protect us?
And what about the ripple effect in the community? Obviously, Disney and Universal are enormous tourist magnets for domestic tourism, Americans, as well as for international tourism.
It is. I mean, last year alone, the parks brought in $26 billion in sales for Disney. So that for the company is about 37% of their income in total. I was speaking to a young woman today at the Orlando International Airport who was going back home to Columbia. And she said she comes here every year, not just to go to the parks, but to shop, to get gifts for her nieces and nephews. So it's not just local people that are, supporting the parks and spending money there, but all around the world.
What about the hotels associated with those parks, directly Disney hotels, Universal hotels?
Yeah, the hotels will remain open, but they have seen a lot of closures, just kind of like the Orange County Convention Center. We've just seen kind of a wave of closures throughout this area. And that's not just international tourists that are canceling. Those are local tourists as well.
And concerning, or curious rather, but low on the priority list, what about ticket refunds for those folks that had been planning on going for these weeks?
Absolutely. Well, I think closed? A lot of people, you know, that's the first thing that comes to their mind, right? And the good thing is that you can get tickets refunded all the way up to, so if you have a ticket that you've purchased and you're an international visitor or a visitor from out of state, you can use that ticket through December 15th or the refund towards a ticket until December 15th. If you are a local Florida resident, you can use that refund on a ticket through July 31st. If you have an annual pass, that will be refunded. And if you've bought special tickets, those will be refunded. Sadly, for a lot of guests, those fast passes, those are canceled. Can't refund those.
Yeah. Daniel Pryor, reporter at WMFE, joining us here. Daniel, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Dr. Servin with Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. How about this idea of closing or postponing or canceling places of large public gatherings or large events? Is this good public policy?
The answer, sadly, and as much as I love getting together at any event, is it is good public policy. One of the elements of preventing the spread of this virus, or any virus for that matter, is the concept of social distancing, and this is how you get at it. It's unpleasant. We as people love being with one another. We enjoy being with one another, but this is how you kind of get at the heart of preventing spread. As painful as it is, it's something that has to be done.
Julio Ochoa, Thursday was, from a reporting standpoint, I have to tell you, it was remarkable to see the kind of cancellations, closings that were happening all across the United States, but particularly here in Florida. Your impression?
Unbelievable, right? Yeah. I've never seen anything like this happen before. It's just amazing. Even after September 11th, I mean, we saw some schools close and some places shut down, but like to see them voluntarily go through this process to stop the spread of this disease is just amazing.
Yeah, one thing, Doctor, I wanted to ask you about as we're approaching the weekend, what about church and temple and religious services? Any kind of recommendations there?
Yeah, it's the same things hold as you kind of imagine. There are ways to kind of get this virtually online from your living room, from your computer website. I think that those are just going to be the way we have to do it for a little bit until this gets stabilized.
You know, there are 11 COVID-19 cases in Broward County. It is the largest concentration of cases among Florida counties. Several of those cases are connected to Port Everglades. That's one of the busiest cruise ports in the world. And earlier today, we spoke with the Port Everglades acting director, Glenn Wiltshire. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. A number of the cases in Broward County that have tested positive for COVID-19 have been connected to Port Everglades. What have you been able to find out about the source of those cases as it relates to the port?
Well, our source of information is the Centers for Disease Control and the Florida Department of Health. So of the five cases that I'm aware of, three worked for a specific company. The other two, we were told, are associated with Port Everglades, but we haven't received specific information yet on where those individuals worked, other than being told that the people were not county employees.
But they were employees of some company working at the port as opposed to cruise passengers, is that right?
Well, I really can't answer that because I'm looking at the notice that was put out by the health department late last night. The indication, it says, this case is associated with Port Everglades, so it does not say what the association is, so it would be incorrect for me to speculate what that association might be.
So what kind of information are you getting from health officials regarding these cases at the port?
So what we're getting, and this one just came out late last night, as I say. So for the other cases, the one case and the three individuals, the three separate cases, worked for Metro Cruise Services. Now, Metro Cruise Services was a subcontractor for Princess Cruises, providing ground support, as they call it, for their operations here at the port. So that's, they're contracted directly by Princess. When we were provided the information about that, we then were able to identify what ships they worked, what cruise terminals they worked out of, and what days that they were involved. And that allows us to actually then look at the operations on our end. We plussed up extra cleaning of the cruise terminals probably about 3 weeks ago when this first started.
Yeah. With the testing of these contract workers, have you requested any COVID-19 tests for other port employees?
No, we haven't. But what we have communicated to our employees and to our port users, because as you know, we're a multi-use port, is that the recommendations we received from the health department, which was unless an individual is starting to exhibiting signs and symptoms of the typical coronavirus or any other symptoms that they're concerned about, to reach out directly to the health department. The health department would then provide them recommendations based on their specific situation and then take appropriate action. I can say that we had one employee who felt that they might have been in contact with one of the individuals, and they were referred to the health department.
And do you know the status of that employee?
That individual was told to come, you know, he was fine to come back to work.
Glenn, let me ask you about cruise operations first. Obviously, the cruise ship industry has been reeling from this. Is there active monitoring or screening going on at the cruise facilities at Port Everglades?
Well, each cruise line has different protocols in place because they're independent companies. However, I think as an industry, they are all screening passengers and crew members before they're allowed to get aboard a ship. That screening actually starts before they even arrive here. They've published, and we have it links on our website, countries or locations where individuals that may have traveled through or originated from over the last 14 or 15 days, I think it varies by cruise line, they ask those same questions when individuals arrive at the port. My understanding is all of the cruise lines that operate out of Port Everglades here are also, you know, they're screening individuals when they check in. If they see any signs or symptoms or something on the declaration, that they're referred over to a separate medical screening. Only if they, you know, pass through those screenings are they allowed aboard the ship.
There's been other recommendations from public health officials regarding the age of cruise ship passengers. Passengers over a certain age, they've been discouraged to go on cruises. Are people being turned away either because of temperature checks or because of age?
I do know because I was up in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday with the senior executives of the four major cruise lines and meeting with the Florida Congressional Delegation as well as others, and they were describing the procedures that they were putting in place to enhance the screening. And one of those, and I heard it yesterday from Carnival Cruise Lines, was that an individual 70 years or older would need to have a doctor's note, and I'm actually reading something that they just literally emailed me 10 minutes ago. Guest 70 years of age or older.
Glenn, it's from Carnival that emailed you? Okay, what's it say, if you could share it with us?
Well, guest 70 years of age or older will not be allowed to sail unless they have a letter from a qualified treating physician confirming that they are fit to sail.
Are these part of the new guidelines that the cruise industry and the vice president, when they were at Port Everglades, began to discuss?
I believe they are. And I say I believe they are because I haven't seen the specific guidelines. However, I do know that the plan that was submitted to the vice president covered three areas. One was prevention, and the screening, enhanced screening programs as part of the prevention. The second part was the detection, getting the test sampling kits on board the ships. The final area is in response. If we get a ship that does have an individual with a positive test, how will that be handled? What's the logistics? And the cruise industry, as I understand it, has put forward a plan where they will assume the primary responsibility for handling those types of issues.
At one of the other large cruise terminals in Port Miami, the mayor in Miami-Dade County has talked about repurposing a warehouse at Port Miami for potentially sheltering folks that may be presumptive positive or positive coming off of cruise ships. Any kind of plan similar at Port Everglades?
No plan like that, because our plan, and we've had a communicable disease response plan here at the port since 2014, is really designed more to facilitate the transfer of individuals off the ship into the appropriate location. We have no facility on the port, so the simple answer is no. We don't have a place here at the port where individuals could be kept for an extended period of time.
That's Glenn Wiltshire, the acting director of Port Everglades. It is a cruise ship and cargo port in Fort Lauderdale. It is the largest cargo port in Florida and one of the largest, busiest cruise ship ports in the world. Broward County has the largest number of COVID-19 confirmed cases of any Florida county, according to the Florida Department of Health here on this Friday as you're listening to the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800 is our phone number. We have a doctor from the Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. We have our health editor from Health News Florida along with us. Your questions about the coronavirus, we're going to run through as many as we can after we take a quick timeout. You can join us on social media as well. At Florida Roundup is the Twitter handle. We've got Doral, West Palm, The Villages, Pembroke Pines all lined up. Your question, your call, your concern, how has the threat of the virus affected your daily life? 305-995-1800. It's all ahead on Florida Public Radio with the Florida Roundup after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. Julio Ochoa is editor at Health News Florida. He's still with us from WUSF in Tampa. And Dr. Joseph Servin is with us, doctor at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Dr. Servin joins us from our sister station in Jacksonville, WJCT. Lots of phone calls here, fellas. We're going to run right to them in Doral in South Florida. Kelvin on line one. Go ahead, Kelvin. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, at the moment I have a bit of a fever, so sorry if I sound a little off. At the moment, my friend who gave me this illness went to the hospital and for mild flu symptoms. He tested negative for the flu, but he was sent home because of the strict criteria. What I'm concerned about is by the time we get more confirmed cases in Florida, it would have already gripped our state.
Kelvin, do you know if your friend was tested for COVID-19?
No, he was not. He was sent home.
He was sent home. Kelvin, how high is your temperature?
About 100.
Okay. Thank you. Doctor, we're not going to diagnose, obviously, anything over the telephone here, but what about kind of the timeline protocol that Kelvin laid out there for a friend of his tested for influenza, test comes back negative, and then sent home?
Well, the key is that the crucial test I didn't hear was done, which is the COVID-19. At the end of the day, that's where they came up with the 14-day quarantine, was like, how long does it take for symptoms to show up if someone's positive? And it can vary anywhere from a few days up to the 11 to 14 days. So in a situation until you're tested, you almost have to assume or presume for safety purposes positivity and kind of distance yourself so that other people don't get sick.
Julio, what about the protocol that Kelvin laid out there? It seems like, if memory serves right, as doctors are able to kind of rule out other flu from certain symptoms, that they perhaps may be led to a COVID-19 request from the Department of Health.
You would think so, but I mean, if you look at the state's website, and I can read it right off there. It says they will test you if you've had close contact with the confirmed COVID-19 case, if they are part of a suspected outbreak, if they've been hospitalized with unexplained coughs or shortness of breath, if they received recently traveled to an area with widespread transmission, or attended a gathering or on a cruise ship that has confirmed cases. Also, if you're 65 or older and have chronic conditions or have symptoms of cough or shortness of breath, those are the criteria the state is following.
In the Villages, Wayne is up next on line four. Go ahead, Wayne. You're on the radio now.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
I've had the flu virus before. I know what it feels like. I know how long it lasts. I've treated it with rest and drinking plenty of fluids. And I didn't have to go to a medical facility. Now, assuming we don't have widespread testing, and I come down with COVID-19, what should I expect from those aspects compared to the flu?
Dr. Servin, how about that?
Sure. So for what we know is the vast majority of people, you won't know the difference between a typical flu from influenza versus COVID-19. Where COVID-19 gets tricky is that there is a higher proportion of people of certain risk groups, those that have a poor immune system, other with chronic conditions or older age, that can become sicker, much sicker, and typically presents as a pneumonia that needs to get treated. But for a big chunk of people, no one would even know that you have it or differentiate it from anything else if you're not in that group that gets sicker from it.
And Julio, we've also heard about asymptomatic cases, right? Folks that may test positive without those kind of symptoms.
Right. That's the real scary thing. You know, who's walking around with this that we don't know about? So, wash your hands, right? That's what we hear.
Don't touch your face.
Careful.
Right. Yeah. We've been repeating that mantra for a good number of weeks now, Doctor. I mean, how effective is that given this can be an airborne respiratory virus?
Well, it's as effective as we can. I mean, the ultimate items are these very serious, scary looking masks that are really there for medical professionals or people who have direct contact. But short of that, the mask is great for people who are sick or might be presumed sick to not spread it. Because again, yeah.
Doctor, is that the N95 mask that you're talking about?
That's the N95. Yeah. But you're not going to distribute that across the way because that would be overkill, to be honest with you. So it's as good as it gets for what we have.
Scott in Tallahassee has a kind of related question to this idea of spread. Go ahead, Scott. You're on the radio now.
Yes, we've heard about the transmission where if someone coughs and it's on a surface, it can last up to 2 hours. If you touch it, then your face or mouth and so forth. But if a person coughs or sneezes in the air and puts a plume in the air, can you seriously walk through that plume a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes later and be infected? Or is that not really a serious method of transmission to worry about?
Dr. Servin?
Great question, and that is one of those unknowns. We all want to know the answer to that. How long the virus can survive on surfaces is still an unclear situation. We know that in general, a few hours at the minimum, but can it last longer than that? That's unknown.
Yeah, there were some studies that NPR was reporting on just this morning here on this Friday morning, Julio, that in lab tests on, I think it was stainless steel and plastic,
right,
that the virus was shown to be able to last up to 72 hours, I think, mm-hmm, in lab conditions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the flu can last, or actually hepatitis A can last for longer than that, several days. Mm. So, you know, this is definitely not a hepatitis A type virus, but it's kind of spooky to think that someone could have passed through an area and you pass behind them, you know, a day later and there you pick up the flu.
Yeah. 305-995-1800. That last voice you heard was Julio Ochoa. He is the editor of Health News Florida. Dr. Joseph Servin is with us as well, doctor at the Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Dr. Servin, what about immunity after the fact? If somebody does contract COVID-19, is tested positive, knows it, Are they immune from it? And if so, for how long? Do we know?
That is that's another unknown question. I will tell you that we know that in some ways that the approach from the United Kingdom and their government, they've actually kind of bet in that direction by allowing things to go forward with the sense of trying to foster herd immunity, if you will, which is getting a larger group of people to be protected for it. How well that immunity works, well, we would hope would be just like anything else, work fairly decently, fairly well. But again, it sits right in that unknown category.
Well, and herd immunity, Julio, is 70%, 80% of a population, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're anywhere close to that. There's what, 42 cases in Florida out of how many million?
Well, confirmed, right? The question there is the testing, the lack of testing capacity, certainly. Gail in Gainesville on line 8. Go ahead, Gail. You are on the radio now.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. We're having a resurgence of the flu here. We've been having it for a long time. When people present to the hospital with flu symptoms and other related issues as a result of it, they're not being tested for COVID-19, not unless they've been to China or they know somebody from China. Don't you think that would be the minimum of risk taking to test people who have the flu, never mind atypical people? We have no idea whatsoever what the community spread is here.
Gail, you're talking about testing for people who have already tested positive for influenza?
No, I'm talking about people who go to the hospital with influenza and they're having trouble breathing and problems, and they're still not testing them.
I see. Yeah. Got it. Gail, thank you very much for that perspective from Gainesville. Nancy in West Palm Beach up next. Nancy, go ahead. You're on the radio now.
Hi. I was calling in to say how this has been affecting me economically. I was just told today that my facility, as a personal trainer and being in a gated community in a gym facility, working with elderly people, is now shut down for a month. I can tell you I am not prepared financially to not have work for a month. But what we are saying is try to get your immune system up. Make sure that you're taking care of yourself to the best of your ability. Hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. But the impact actually started weeks ago when people were coming from or going out of town and not feeling staying home anyway. So economically, it's just disastrous.
Yeah, Nancy, sorry to hear about that, but thank you for sharing that. Dr. Servin, how about this idea of the timeline? Some organizations like Disney and Universal closing for a couple of weeks. Some performing arts centers we know about are closing, shutting down for a month. Some big events are delaying for 3 or 4 months. What is the guided timeline kind of to see the visibility?
Yeah, at the end, if you have to kind of, it's almost doing a mathematical formula. So if you assume if someone can be potentially up to 14 days where they're infectious, it's trying to figure out where you can get the biggest proportion of people that you are going to cover with kind of these mandates to not get together. This is uncharted waters for us, and how long it is, you don't know until it's done and you kind of judge in retrospect.
What does that mean, do you think, Doctor? It's done. Is there a level of infection rate?
That you're at a level of infection rate that is manageable, that there's perhaps treatment, there's a larger group of people that are immune, that you've in essence tried to silence the possibility of community spread where you can't detect where it's going on, and that it's like any of the other infections that we've learned to basically live our life around, such as the flu and other viruses.
Yeah. Dr. Joseph Servin has been with us this whole hour. He is with the Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. Doctor, thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us and the Florida Public Radio audience.
Tom, anytime. Thank you.
Julio, always great to have you on the program. Great reporting as always, Julio. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Julio Ochoa, the editor at Health News Florida from WUSF. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Denise Royal and Heather Schatz are the producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director. The Director of Radio Operations in Miami is Peter Meritz. Big engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and supporting Public Radio. We'll talk to you next week.